This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello and welcome to Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy. In this half hour, I'll be reading articles of interest from magazines like Self-Reliance and Hobby Farms. Today's half hour will feature some gardening articles and a cooking article. So without further ado, let's get started with Mother Earth News, the original guide to living wisely. This is from February-March 2024 magazine. And this first article is promised a gardening article. It's called Simple Affordable Seed Starting. A healthy garden begins with healthy seedlings. Learn just how easy it is to achieve it. By Samuel Feldman. Starting seeds at home enables gardeners to cultivate strong plants that are ready for the ground come springtime, while also bringing the joy of gardening indoors during the more dormant time of year. Luckily, you don't need to spend much money on seed starting kits and supplies. With just a few containers, homemade seed starting mix, and some paper, you can grow excellent transplants for your garden. Start the seeds. Begin growing your seedlings in a controlled environment using a sterile medium. You can do this in a variety of ways. Peat pellets, compressed dried circles of peat, have been prevalent in the gardening market for a while. Though inexpensive and simple to use, they also pose environmental issues. If you want an alternative kind of pellet, consider ones made from coconut coir. To forego pellets altogether, create compost, sterilize it, add it to a seed starting mix, and then use soil blockers to make a molded mound of soil to germinate seeds. It's possible to omit this step and plant directly into 3-inch pots with good results. Generally, bigger seeds are easier to start directly in pots as they germinate quickly, while smaller seeds could be washed away and sit at the surface, which dries out quickly. With any seed starting method, pay close attention to the instructions on your seed packet, as that'll inform you of what conditions your plants need to germinate and grow successfully and the best practices for sowing seeds. Understand the plant's needs, including humidity, heat, water, soil conditions, and sunlight before you place the first seeds into the soil. After planting, cover the seeds and soil with plastic or glass. Some seed starting trays come with their own plastic lids, and place them in a warm and well-lit area. As soon as the seedlings emerge, remove the cover and place the seedlings in a sunny spot, ideally somewhere they can get 8 hours of sun or under a grow light. If some seedlings haven't sprouted yet, you may need to separate the germinated seedlings into an uncovered container while leaving the remaining ones covered. Throughout this seed starting process, keep the soil and seeds moist. Only water when soil surfaces begin to look dry. Transplant seedlings into 3-inch pots when a few second true leaves appear. Make paper pots. Paper pots are free, and you can make as many as you need. Unlike plastic pots, paper pots decompose, so you won't need to wash and store them after planting. You can use newspapers or paper bags from the grocery store. And if you make a lot of them while your seedlings develop, you'll have plenty ready by replanting time. To make paper pots, you'll need paper, scissors, and a cylindrical object such as a bottle or a jar with a diameter of roughly 3 inches, 4.5 inches for larger pots. Cut the paper into rectangular pieces about 17 inches long by 6 inches wide. These measurements will work well for sturdy paper. Thinner paper may need to be longer. Take the bottle or other round cylinder and, starting on one end of the paper, roll the bottle while wrapping the paper around it. After that, slide the bottom edge of the paper about 1.5 inches below the bottle and fold it over the bottle's base to create the bottom of the pot. press the bottle's base onto a flat surface to solidify those folds, and then slide the paper pot off the bottle. If the paper on the bottom keeps unfolding, push it from the bottom exterior with your fingers and then press it down again using a bottle from inside the pot to solidify those folds. To make 4.5-inch pots, repeat the procedure using 22-inch long and 9-inch wide pieces of paper and a roughly 4.5-inch diameter bottle. Make your own seed starting mix. The heart of seed starting, the soil mix, is one of the most important parts of growing your own seedlings and also one of the most expensive. By making your own soil mix, you can grow seedlings with good results and minimum costs. The following mix can be used for seed starting, replanting, or even potting soil for container plants. Typically, I can make 40 quarts of seed starting mix for $24. To start, you'll need cheap potting soil, perlite, sold at some stores and garden centers, and a small plastic net, such as the plastic netting from grocery store onions. Potting soil with perlite provides good drainage, absorbs moisture, and has an even and light texture. Notably, your seed starting mix should be sterile so it won't harbor any disease organisms that could infect your plants, or if you give away any seedlings, other people's gardens. One method to sterilize soil is to put 3 to 4 inches of soil in a baking pan, cover with foil if moist, and bake for about 30 minutes at 180 degrees Fahrenheit, or until the soil temperature is higher than 160 degrees. First, sift the potting soil to remove large pieces and make it light and airy. To do this, cut one side of the plastic net to make an opening. Using gloves, put several handfuls of potting soil into the net. Close the opening with your hand and shake the net over a tray to sift the soil. Sift inside a large bag to avoid creating a mess. Some clumps and wood chips will remain in the net. Empty them into another bag. You can later use them as mulch. Repeat with another batch of potting mix until you've sifted the amount of soil needed. Then mix in the perlite at a ratio of 1 part perlite to 4 parts of sifted potting soil. After mixing the ingredients, you'll have a wonderful seed starting mix. Replant the seedlings. I've achieved my best results by planting seedlings into small pots and then replanting them into larger pots as they grow. This allows for maximum root development while ensuring the plants always have the right amount of growing medium without any unused soil that could harbor diseases and fungi or increase the risk of root rot. After 1 or 2 months, many blooming annuals will start to blossom, and tomato plants will be about 8 inches tall with their first blossoms that'll develop as the plant grows larger. Replanting times and plant sizes vary. Here's a system that works well for me. When the seedlings show their second leaves, transplant them into 3-inch paper pots. First, I cover the surface I'll be working on with newspaper to avoid a mess. I fill paper pots halfway with seed starting mix. Then I carefully place the seedlings in the half-filled pot. If using pellets, remove the netting. I fill the edges with more soil mix, lightly tamp it down, and water. Depending on the crop, some seedlings will need to be replanted a second time because they'll likely get root-bound in the first container, unless you plant them directly into the garden by then. The procedure for replanting the second time is the same, only you'll use 4.5-inch diameter paper pots. Plant tomato seedlings deeper than they were in the first pot. Plant other seedlings at the same level. Carefully unwrap the seedlings from the previous paper pots before planting in the second, because although paper easily biodegrades outside, it won't biodegrade indoors in the seed mix, which lacks the bacteria and organisms needed for decomposition. Transplanting outside. Around the last frost date, the specific timing depends on the crop, your seedlings should be ready for transplanting into the garden. Harden the transplants beforehand by gradually exposing them to the outside conditions in a protected place, starting about 10 days before planting. Also, check the weather forecast to make sure there won't be any dips in temperature that could harm the plants. It's better to wait several days than to risk ruining the transplants. Water the plants in garden bed several hours before planting. In early spring, plant in the morning so the plants have time to adjust before the cooler night temperatures set in. In late spring, summer, or fall, plant on a cloudy day or in the afternoon, late afternoon, so the plants will have some time to adjust before the midday sun. To plant, dig a hole as deep as the plant's root ball and a little wider. Tomatoes are best planted deeper. You can plant the paper pots directly in the soil as they'll quickly biodegrade. Lightly firm the soil and water. Your transplants should grow to produce beautiful blooms and abundant harvests. Store leftover seeds. Most of the time, you'll have leftover seeds from planting. Properly stored seeds can last much longer than those just stored in the packet. If storing at room temperature or in the fridge, keep the seeds in their packet and place them in a container such as a cardboard box, along with a small amount of moisture-absorbing silica gel available at most craft stores. If freezing your seeds, cover them in plastic and keep in an airtight container to protect them from condensation from when they thaw later on. Avoid leaving seeds exposed on a humid day, as this could drastically reduce storage life. Samuel Feldman is a farmer and writer by both hobby and profession who's currently researching new crops and agricultural techniques. His work has been published in multiple publications, including Farming Magazine, Acres USA, and Countryside. The next article comes from the same Mother Earth News publication. It's entitled, Can Coconut Coir Save the World? This humble coconut byproduct offers an eco-friendly alternative to peat moss and so much more, by Kenny Coogan. As someone with a degree in global sustainability who runs a carnivorous plant nursery, I initially questioned the use of coconut coir in horticulture as compared with peat moss. This was especially true during the COVID-19 pandemic when bales of peat moss disappeared off the shelves of big box stores. Because of its high capacity for water retention, peat moss is in many store-bought soil and seed starter mixes. It's also used in the soil mixture for carnivorous plants and as a soil amendment for acid-loving plants such as blueberries, camellias, azaleas, and tomatoes. Peat moss is formed when partially decomposed plant material accumulates at the bottom of a wetland, known as a peatland, when there's peat moss in it, and over thousands of years gradually turns into peat moss. The lack of oxygen in the peatland prevents the plant material from fully decomposing, and thus keeps carbon dioxide from being released into the atmosphere. As a result, peatlands store more atmospheric carbon dioxide than even forests. And they're recognized as a global carbon sink, an area where large amounts of carbon are stored. Peatlands make up around 3% of the Earth's terrestrial land, and while the majority of the world's peatlands are believed to be in the boreal and temperate regions of the Northern Hemisphere, peatlands can be found on all continents, including tropical areas such as the Congo Basin and Southeast Asia, and yes, even the maritime Antarctic region. The problem with using peat moss is that it isn't sustainable. The process of draining the peatlands and extracting peat moss destroys the unique ecosystem and biodiversity of the peatlands. Furthermore, damaged peatlands can then become a source of carbon emissions, thus compounding the climate crisis. It's these environmental issues that have led to a ban on sales of horticultural peat in England starting this year. Coconuts to the rescue? An alternative to peat moss often used in Africa and Asian countries is coconut coir, a byproduct of the coconut industry. Coconut coir consists of fiber taken from the outer husk of the coconut. In the past few decades, coconut coir has been advertised to the pet reptile industry as a bedding substitute, and more recently promoted as a replacement for peat moss in horticulture. However, as I've learned, this is only the beginning of what coconut coir can offer. Matthew Gresick is the founder and CEO of Globe Eco, an agriculture-based climate tech business. He owns coconut plantations in the Philippines, and his company is turning coconut coir into tables, chairs, floors, and walls. It has a process for turning coconut coir into a timber replacement to stop deforestation. Gresick understands that when you drain the peatlands, you also disturb a lot of embedded carbon. Whereas in the case of the coconut coir, it was a waste material anyway, Gresick says. The tree had already sequestered the carbon and turned it into a planting material. A coconut tree will grow to a certain height and then it doesn't grow anymore, Gresick continues. All photosynthesis and carbon dioxide removal goes into the fruits, which fall off on the ground and turn into waste, or the branches that fall off. Compare that to a regular tree that stores its carbon in the root system, leaves, and stems, he says. As the tree grows, it gets larger and larger. But for coconut trees, they shed their fronds 14 times a year and generally produce fruit twice a year. So you're talking about generating a tremendous amount of biomass, he says. This can be raw materials for building materials or for planting materials, and there are no other plants on Earth that do that. The first step from coconut husk to planting material is to dry out the plant material. Gresick estimates the moisture content as around 60%, and his company uses a machine that hammers the husks to remove the moisture. Depending on the process, you can be left with the fibers typically called coconut coir, or larger pieces called coconut chips or mulch. According to Gresick, the husks make up about 30% of the weight of a coconut. The husk is pretty much universally garbage in coconut countries, as it's discarded and typically burned, Gresick says. He estimates around 10 million tons of carbon dioxide go up from burning the coconut husks each year. His company instead takes those fibers and turns them into a product that's standardized for building materials. Those building materials should last 100 years, which helps Gresick and his team calculate the amount of atmospheric carbon removed. Gresick's company is currently contending in the XPRIZE carbon removal competition. The goal of the competition is to tackle humanity's bigger threat, fighting the climate crisis and rebalancing the Earth's carbon cycle. The grand prize winner will receive $100 million to further their business or organization. Gresick is focused on the numbers. They're really concerned with two things: how much carbon dioxide is removed from the environment and at what cost, he explains. He's aiming for a target of around 30,000 tons of carbon dioxide removed a year. But carbon dioxide removal isn't his only focus. What's really interesting is the top four coconut countries represent the top four polluters of ocean plastics, Gresick says. This is amazing because they're small countries, yet they're the largest sources of ocean plastics in the entire world. We developed a process where we take up to 40% by weight of the coconut fibers and combine it with unrecyclable waste plastic and incorporate it into the building material. Imagine the impact if this process became widespread: a reduction in carbon emissions and plastic pollution, but also a decrease in deforestation as a result of alternative building supplies. Costs and benefits. One criticism of coconut coir from residents of the United States is that coconuts are grown on the other side of the world, while peat can be harvested nearby in Canada and South America. Everything has a cost, says T.H. Culhane, an associate professor at the Patel College of Global Sustainability at the University of South Florida. People in the permaculture, renewables, and environmental spaces have somehow been lulled into thinking we can find a holy grail with no downside. Yet there's going to be a cost to everything from some organism's or person's perspective or some system's perspective. Culhane offers three questions to consider. What do we really care about? Which system do we want to benefit the most? And whom are we trying to protect? While transporting coconut coir from Asia uses fossil fuels, trucking peat moss from Canada to the United States also consumes fossil fuels. Additionally, there are coconut plantations worldwide, not just in Southeast Asia. Culhane believes many coastlines in the United States could benefit from using coconut palms to help with storm surges, since they're one of the few crops that will grow in saltwater. Coconut coir has a promising future ahead of it in the global efforts for sustainability. Swap out peat moss for coconut coir in your next gardening project. Check out some of my recommendations for soil and seed starting mixes below to get started. Kenny Coogan earned a master's degree in global sustainability and has published over 400 articles on pets, livestock, and gardening. He lives on a one-acre homestead with chickens and ducks, managing a permaculture-style landscape. Coogan also runs a successful carnivorous plant nursery in Tampa, Florida. Here's the other inset article that the author mentioned, coconut coir soil and seed starting mixes. Since coconuts are traditionally grown on the coasts, coconut coir and fibers may be salty. Soak them for 6 to 12 hours, drain the water, and repeat the process two more times to remove the excess salt. Removing the salt from coconut products is especially important for carnivorous plants, which are sensitive to it. Some coconut products for gardening will advertise that they've already been triple washed. Here are a couple of seed starting recipes that he gives. Vegetable and ornamental seed starting mix. One part coconut coir, one part perlite, and one half to one part vermiculite. For potting mix, go with 6 parts of coconut coir and compost, and 1 part of perlite and 1 part of vermiculite. For freestanding garden beds, 1 part coconut coir and 3 parts of compost or native soil. Let's now switch to Self-Reliance Magazine, Spring 2024, issue number 32. This is a recipe, it's a regular column called Leanie in the Kitchen by Eileen Duffy. Raisin banana bread. There are so many reasons to bake bread. I don't know about your neck of the woods, but here in Oregon, a good quality loaf costs more than $5 in the market, whereas the ingredients to make just as good a loaf cost a fraction of that. Another benefit is I know exactly what ingredients go into my bread. It's so easy and quick to make using my trusty bread machine. I've had one for about 30 years and love using it. To make things convenient, I have a baking cabinet at home, so most of my bread baking ingredients are handy in one place. My husband Dave and I don't eat as much bread as we used to, so quite often our 3 grown sons and daughters are the happy recipients of a big chunk of fresh bread to take home. Recently, I had some bananas that were too ripe to be good for eating fresh. I looked in one of my bread machine cookbooks for inspiration and found a recipe that uses both regular flour and whole wheat flour, oats, and a small banana. Perfect. The recipe called for macadamia nuts, but I wanted a sweet bread to go along with the banana flavor, so I omitted the nuts and added raisins and cinnamon. The first loaf I tried came out quite nice, but a bit too dry and very dense, although it was perfect for making French toast. Try again is my motto when things don't turn out as nicely as I'd like. Dave suggested I add an egg to the next batch. Brilliant. The second version I made was moist and delicious, toasted with butter or jam. I shared it with the staff at the magazine office. And here is Eileen's recipe for raisin banana bread. 1 1/3 cups of milk, 3 tablespoons of unsalted butter cut into cubes, 1 small overripe banana cut into thin slices, 1 egg slightly whisked, 2 1/2 cups of flour, 1 1/2 cups of whole wheat flour, 3/4 cup 1 minute oats, 4 tablespoons of sugar, 1 tablespoon plus a teaspoon of gluten, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/3 cup of raisins, 1 teaspoon of cinnamon, and 1 tablespoon of bread machine yeast. In a microwavable bowl, add the milk and butter. Heat the mixture until just warm but not hot. Add the banana slices and use a knife to cut them into smaller pieces. Stir in the egg and set aside. In a bowl, add the remaining ingredients except the yeast and mix thoroughly. Add the wet ingredients to the bread machine pan, then add the dry ingredients on top. Make a well in the flour mixture and spoon the yeast into the well. Set the bread machine to the dough cycle. This recipe makes a big loaf, so I used my long bread pan. Otherwise, you'll want to halve the dough and put it into 2 regular loaf pans. Coat your bread pan with canola oil, then sprinkle a generous amount of flour on the oil. When the dough cycle is finished, shape the bread to fit your baking pan. Cover with a dampened kitchen towel and let rise in a warm place for about an hour. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit and bake for 25 to 30 minutes. Let rest in the pan just a few minutes, then cool completely on a rack. We have just a little bit of time left, so I'm going to switch to staying in the same publication. Another regular column, the Ask Jackie column. Jackie Clay Atkinson answers your canning, livestock, and homesteading questions. So let's see what some of the readers are asking about. KFC dressing for coleslaw. I'm interested in canning some shredded cabbage and carrots to use in making coleslaw. I've made your Amish canned coleslaw before and liked it, but the family really likes the KFC copycat coleslaw I often make. It has a mayonnaise-based dressing, so I know it can't be canned that way, but I was thinking if I just canned the cabbage and carrots, I could use them with the KFC dressing by draining them first and then adding the dressing. To can the cabbage and carrots for that, would I just use vinegar? Given that the vegetables are low acid, how much vinegar would you recommend? Would I need to add salt? Any advice you'd have would be greatly appreciated. That was asked by Linda King of Bolton, Massachusetts. I would just use the Amish coleslaw recipe as is. Then if you want to make KFC coleslaw, just drain it and add your dressing. I prefer my coleslaw with the vinegar and spices, where my husband Will likes his with mayonnaise. So when I open a jar of Amish coleslaw, I spoon some for me into a dish, then drain the rest and add the mayonnaise. That way, we're both happy with very little work. Cutting winter squash and growing corn. I was successful at growing and harvesting some winter squash from seeds purchased from Seed Treasures. Exciting. Now some of that squash is huge and has a very hard shell. Do you have a recommended method to cut these squash, and what do you use? I'm rather anxious about cutting myself. I ordered Simonette Sweet Corn, 65 days, Seneca Sunrise Corn, 67 days, and Who Gets Kissed Corn, 80 days. It is my understanding that with corn, there's cross-pollination, and one should avoid this with different varieties. We do have approximately 250 feet of distance from one growing area to another, which should hopefully be helpful. How do I plant these varieties of corn to avoid cross-pollination? Would spacing the planting of the varieties be a solution, and if so, how many days apart? In which order would you recommend planting the varieties? In any other words of wisdom. Also, we live on the West Coast, so the growing season is cooler. There are people who do grow sweet corn in this area, as the for sale sign indicates, in September, and of course, feed corn that is harvested with a stalk. Sorry, I'm not much of a farmer. That was written by Kat from Cedro Woolley, Washington. First off, let me congratulate you on your harvest. I cut my squash open using one of two methods. The one I use most often is to lay the squash on its side on an old wooden chair seat. Then I take a sturdy, thinner blade knife and poke it in and down, rocking the blade downward as I go. This works with nearly all of our squash. If I have a very hard-shelled one, Will gets out his DeWalt reciprocating saw and cuts the squash in half with that. A hatchet also works, but gives you less control. Home growing seed to save is much easier than it is to grow seed for market, as we do, to ensure absolute purity. I would suggest planting the Who Gets Kissed, which is a longer day corn upwind from one of the other shorter day corns, then planting the other short season corn as far from them as you can. Also, if you plant your early season corns at 2 week staggered dates, most should pollinate fully before the other corn gets to that stage. And of course, that was Jackie's answer for that very long question. Well, it looks like we're just about out of time. You've been listening to another episode of Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy, and as always, thank you for listening.